Don't get bored.
Oh, well.
You're not bored. You're not bored yet. You're going to talk about your family. You're going to talk about your work. And, this was a very, very moving book. In a way, I felt almost like a voyeur.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking into other people's lives. In the beginning, you mentioned that you were sitting in your father's study or living room, I can't remember, and you see a table, and it has a kind of a chest on it.
Right.
And you opened it, and what did you see?
Well, it was a little file cabinet that had been built for my parents by a man who worked for them in for the school where my father was headmaster right after World War II. And it was a file cabinet that contained the family records, not historical or ancestral, but the carbon copies of letters that my father had written, health records, financial records, and so forth. It had always been locked when I was a boy, and when I was small, it was sort of a mysterious box to me, and then I grew up, and I didn't think about it. And my mother had died. This was in the fall of '86. She died a couple of months before. I was there visiting my father, and I brushed my hand against it, and the top started to open. And I looked inside. It was jammed full of papers. And I started reading around in them. And obviously my immediate reaction was one of a son's curiosity. It's not so much that the documents were intimate as that there were, for example, no love letters between my parents that I'm aware of. It's just that they provided so much minute detail about the daily lives of my parents. And I started thinking about them. I was at a stage in my life where I was very preoccupied with my work at the Washington Post and had no intention of writing another book. But this book just, this material started tugging at me. And I began to wonder whether in those letters and family records, with all their wonderful detail, if I might not have the raw material to do a book about what fairly ordinary American middle-class lives are like. My parents' marriage had lasted almost exactly a half century, which was a convenient sort of framework, and I just began to wonder whether in their lives, which were quite ordinary, interesting to them and their family, but like most lives, unexciting and essentially uneventful, I wondered whether there might not be a story that other people who've led unexciting and uneventful lives might not connect with. And I eventually decided to do it. I am not a writer of fiction, but this is as close as I will ever come to being able to tell a story in the novelist sense of the phrase. And it's my family's story, my parents' story, as seen, I hope, through their eyes rather than through my own. I call them by their first names rather than my mother and my father, because it seemed to me, if I said, my mother said this, my father said this, in a scene in which I'm not present, I would automatically become present just by saying my mother. The reader would be reminded of me. Well, that's not what I wanted to do. There are plenty of books written by people about their own lives. I thought it would be interesting to try to write a family book about somebody else in the family.
You have an awful lot of background about the family history, all of the ancestors and so forth. And I guess a lot of that you can thank your father for.
Yes, in fact, almost all of it. He was a nut on the subject of genealogy. There was actually a lot more genealogical material in the original draft of the book than there is now. There was some feeling on my editor's part, which I soon came to share, that the real story in this book is of Bill and Helen Yardley, and that the genealogical material, particularly up toward the front, was getting in the way of the story. So we've trimmed it down a lot. I've never been a genealogy nut myself. You know, when one of your parents goes overboard on something, a child's reaction very often is to go in exactly the opposite direction. So when Dad would start talking about Jonathan Edwards or Theodore Dwight Woolsey or one of the other ancestors whom my father thought was quite remarkable, I would tend to tune out. But in doing this book, I had to learn it all for myself, and I did find it interesting. I think everybody's family is interesting, and I'm just lucky in having had a lot of documentary material that was around to give me some sense of these people's lives.
Well, you really did. You had things like grocery lists. And
right.
Bills of sale.
Well, those grocery lists were remarkable.
Did your mother keep all these
grocery lists? No, not literally. She kept a ledger. She was very efficient about money. They had very little money throughout their married lives, and they had to budget. They had to watch every penny. They were married in 36 when nobody had very many pennies. And she kept this ledger, I guess, as a way of forcing herself to stick to a budget. And, you know, it was a little bound book, a notebook. And there it was. It was in that file. I had never been aware of it. And literally, there are, in her very delicate handwriting, there are lists, not shopping lists, but lists of what she had bought that day at the market. And she just entered it all in, I guess, so that at week's end or month's end or whatever, she could look and see, well, this is how much we spent, so we can predict that this is how much we'll spend next month. I have no idea precisely why she did it, but that's my assumption. Oh, and, you know, these days when you enter retirement and you start getting ill and old, as happens to all of us, the amount of documentary material that comes at you is staggering because of Medicare and because of health insurance. And there was the fattest file in there was medical records. Ultimately, I decided not to dwell on that. My mother had cancer and my mother had hardening of, my mother had cancer and my father had hardening of the arteries to the brains, and there's really not much more to say than that. So I decided not in the end to go into a lot of detail about their final illnesses, but it was all there.
Your father saved all of his correspondence.
Well, he had from 1949 until 1971, he had the services of a secretary. He was the rector, headmaster of a school in Southern Virginia called Chatham Hall, a girls' boarding school. And Dad luxuriated in having a secretary. And he did, as I say in the prologue to this book, with one distinct and interesting exception, he did all of his correspondence by dictation. And he saved carbons. And that's what I had. It's funny that I have almost, I think I may have two or three original letters that he wrote to me when I was a boy. But in this file named Jonathan, I found dozens of carbons that he had saved of letters that had come to me. And so I was able to piece together all sorts of things. I was talking to a friend of mine about my father the other day, somebody who knew my father. His letters are a very important part of this book. He was a fabulous letter writer. His letters are funny, outrageous, and they're always extraordinarily literate. And to think that he was writing these as he was speaking, off the top of his head, and they were never edited. He spoke them, the secretary typed them up, and he signed them. And they're remarkable documents. Anybody who writes professionally can look at those letters and realize that this man was quite a writer.
And a very paternalistic writer, as he wrote to his children, cautioning them about the proper way to live and this
right.
sort of thing, and from his very conservative
Well, you know, it's funny. He was a conservative man, and yet he voted Democrat throughout his life, and as I say, his first vote was for, in 1932, was for the socialist candidate Norman Thomas. One of the things that doing this book taught me is that people are a lot more complicated than the labels we tend to attach to them, and that a man who dressed conservatively and in social and cultural terms was conservative was, in other senses of the word, quite a liberal. Liberal in his reading tastes, that is to say, open to new ideas, open to new forms of writing. Liberal in his social attitudes, and a general.
And in fact, he made certain reforms at the girls' school.
Well, into what was a very hidebound, it was a very pleasant place, but a very hidebound and rather conservative girls' school. He liberalized dress regulations. He gave girls greater freedom to leave the campus. And remember, we're talking in the 1950s, when in a private school, those restrictions were likely to be quite stringent. So he did that. He presided over the desegregation of the school in 1967 or 8. And I would say that he left Chatham Hall, when he left it in 1971, it was a much freer place than it had been when he got there.
Your mother and father had a very ritualized life.
Absolutely.
The cocktail hour
right.
was done in a certain way. Your father became an Episcopalian minister. How did this come about? Why did he decide to do that?
Well,
because I guess it ran deeply within the family.
Well, it did run deeply in the family. His father and his grandfather had been Episcopal ministers, and my father had always had a lot of sympathy for the rituals of the church and for the language of the church, the King James Bible, the Book of Common Prayer, great, great old books. And as I recall, as a small boy, I had been taken to church when we were living first in Tuxedo Park, New York, and then in Chatham. But Chatham Hall, when he took the rector's job there, was a church-affiliated school. It was not a church school, but it was affiliated with the Episcopal Church, and its previous rectors had always been ministers as well as headmasters. And when he was being interviewed for the position, there was some reluctance on the part of the trustees to hire somebody who was not a minister, which meant they would have to find a minister too. I have no actual firm evidence of this, but in my understanding, which others at Chatham have confirmed, is that my father pretty much agreed as a condition of employment that he would enter the ministry. It was a practical decision. He was not on the road to Gethsemane and struck by a moment of spiritual awakening. He did it because it would advance his career. I don't mean to make it to sound cynical about it, but everybody I know who knew him feels that that was the case. He eventually became quite a good minister.
And that was probably a very good thing for him to do because toward the end, during his retirement, he was able to take small ministerial jobs.
That's right. He had small churches in Rhode Island, and he was a good minister in, I think, the literal sense of the term. He ministered to the needs of old, dying people, and he could be very, when he was away from them, he could be quite critical of them and sometimes quite amusingly so, but when he was with them, which is all that mattered to them, he was kind and patient and considerate and willing to listen and hold their hands and say prayers with them. And, you know, in the last waning hours of an old life, that can be a great solace.
Now, your parents had quite a windfall as they approached retirement in terms of your father's book collection. Tell me about that.
Well, he had been a collector of mostly of Victorian novels, specifically the work of the great British novelist Anthony Trollope. He had gotten them at sharply reduced prices through the offices of the Redwood Library in Middletown, of which he was a small stockholder. They had inherited, or they had acquired by bequest, a large and very fine collection, which duplicated books they already had. And they said to my father, the people at the library knew that Dad loved books. This was in 56 or 7, 50, in mid-50s. They said, go on down to the basement. We have all those books, and you can have them for 50 cents a piece or a dollar for the large folio-sized volumes. Well, it was, I think, the great moment of his life. He walked in, and there was Dickens in serial and for 50 cents. And he spent about $500, which for him was stretching himself to the absolute limits. Eventually, he acquired more books over the years, but he auctioned them off at Park Burnett in 1971, 2, and 3 for a total of about $35,000. And that was the nest egg that my parents had when they retired, which, among other things, shows how limited their resources were. That was really just about it in terms of ready cash when they left Chatham Hall.
Still, you're talking about, when did he leave?
In 1971. So in today's dollars, that might be $100,000, perhaps.
In your memoir, you shed an awful lot of light about yourself and your relationship with other people and an awkward relationship with other people at Groton. Tell me about this.
Well, I was a scholarship student from 1954 until my graduation in 1957 at Groton, the premier boys' boarding school. And I didn't like being a scholarship boy. I was the son of people who had little money but who spent their lives as servants to the rich, which is what the headmaster of a private school is, and his wife. And I had my full share of resentments about that, and I didn't like being, in effect, a poor boy surrounded by rich boys and not being able to do the things that they were able to do to make the trips to Bermuda and, you know, buy the expensive clothes. There's no question that it was a chip that I carried on my shoulder, and I think to some degree I have a small version of that chip on my shoulder now. The Groton chapter is really the only place in the book where, for more than a page or two, I come to the center of the narrative. This is my parents' story, not my own, and I step in the background as much as possible. The reason I come to the center stage there is that this was a chance to write about the world of private schools, the world my parents lived in a personal way that I hope would illuminate the sort of world they lived in. But it was not intended to put my own psyche on the line.
Well, you were unhappy at Groton, and you had an awkward relationship with the headmaster there.
Right.
So you also write that when an invitation came for you to receive an award.
Well, I was really astonished about four or five years ago. The Groton School, the headmaster, Bill Polk, very nice man, who was a year behind me in school there, called me up and asked me to come up to Groton in the late spring of 1987. to receive their, quote, Distinguished Grottonian Award, which is given annually to an alumnus. Well, I was bowled over. I'd had a very unhappy relationship with the school while I was there, and I'd paid as little attention to it as possible thereafter. But this was one of those invitations that you really can't say no to. And I went up to Groton. It turned out to be a very happy occasion. My wife came with me. By coincidence, it was the 30th reunion of my own class, and about a dozen of the 40 members of that class were there. I hadn't seen any of them for 30 years, and they turned out to be nice guys, and they had nice women attached to them, so that was pleasant, and the school really is a lovely place.
And in your speech, you only zing them a little bit.
Well, in the speech, I told them that I hoped that they had become more tolerant of eccentricity and nonconformity than they had been when I was there. And I said at the end that Chairman Mao was right, let up 100 flowers bloom and 100 voices contend. And I'm glad I said that to them.
It should be noted, of course, to the listener that your family very much certifiable WASP, card-carrying WASP.
Card-carrying WASPs. You are what you are, and you can't change it. And that's one of the things I'm trying to say in this book. We're born into, and we spend our lives in relatively narrow worlds, whatever those worlds are. And you can be in a narrow world among people who have biases, prejudices, personal and communal histories that may not be all that attractive. You can be in that world and still be a good person, still lead a productive and interesting life. It doesn't matter whether you're WASP or black or Polish or Jewish or a journalist or a businessman or whatever. You have a world. And it seems to me that how you lead your life inside that world is a lot more important than what that world is itself. And I think that my parents led, if not exemplary lives, led good lives. And being a WASP was important to understanding them, just as whatever somebody else is important to understanding that person. Being a WASP has never been a big deal to me one way or the other, but I've gotten a little bit tired of the rather reflexive criticism that WASPs are subjected to these days. I think that the WASP tradition is just as honorable as any other, and no more honorable than any other, I might add. So there's an element in this book of paying a sort of a quiet tribute to an American, I guess you could call us a minority.
Well, you know about the Columbus Day Parade of Italians. They march up Fifth Avenue by the thousands.
Right.
The Martin Luther King Day Parade, by the thousands they march up Fifth Avenue. And the Von Steuben Day Parade, by the thousands they march up Fifth Avenue. Now, the WASP have their own parade.
What is that?
They march across Fifth Avenue.
We have the Easter Parade.
Now, one of the most disturbing portions of our kind of people is toward the end, as you mark your parents' decline. And I was thinking about that as I saw their illnesses and their infirmities and their inability to get around anymore, their loss of intellectual power. And as I was reading this portion of your book, I began to think, isn't that sad? You know, all of us will end somehow in a sad and unpleasant way.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you were struck by that part of the book, because to me it's the most important part of the book. What I wanted, when the book began to take shape in my mind, it really started to take shape from the end and work back to the beginning. I don't know what it is about Americans, but we have lost the ability to face death squarely. We somehow think that if you read American fiction these days, and you would come away from it with the notion that death is unfair, that somehow it's unjust that you die. I don't see an alternative, at least if there is one. No one has shown it to me yet. It seemed to me that there might be something helpful, perhaps therapeutic, not just for me but for other people, to read an honest, unsentimental account of how two people died. And that's what I have tried to do. I've tried to say in the last two chapters of this book, this is how we die now in the American middle class. My mother dying painfully of cancer, my father dying slowly and sort of fuzzily of a form of senility. The kind of fading out that we do in our lives. I think that those of us who are in our late 40s, early 50s, we're beginning to understand that now for the first time in our lives. Our parents are dying, some of our friends are dying, and we're having to face up to death in ways that we could avoid earlier. I don't pretend that I've done anything that will be a sort of a religious experience for readers, but enough people have told me that both of my parents' generation and of my own, that those last 40 pages have connected with their own experience. A few people have said, thank you for saying that. And that, if that's the response that I'm getting, then I think that the book will be worthwhile.
You know, what worries me about dying is, two things worry me at my middle age, early middle age. One, that I'm wasting too much time.
Mm-hmm.
And two, that I'm not going to finish what I know I should be
mm-hmm.
doing. In having this feeling, this, I think, shows an awareness that time is running out.
Oh, you know, you and I are of roughly the same age, and there's no question, particularly after a parent has lived into his or her 70s and then died, this is the time in life when you do really begin to become aware of the evanescence of it, of how little time is left. I think of death in somewhat different terms. I think of it just as not being there to see things anymore and missing things. But then I think, well, but I'm not going to know. And I find working on this book, writing the account of my parents' death was not a painful experience for me. People think it was, but it wasn't. It was a sad story, but it was a story that I wanted to tell. And it may have been a therapeutic experience for me in that sense. It enabled me to come to terms with my sorrow at my parents' death and the way that death came to them. But it's something this book did for me was to reconcile me to the inevitability of my own death. I would rather, and I'm not going to have any choice in the matter, if I did, I would rather fade out the way my father did, even though there was something rather undignified about it, slowly losing touch with the world so that you don't know what you're losing. I'd rather go out that way than the way my mother did, her mind sharp to the very end, in real pain, seeing herself waste away.
Well, there's another way, too, and that's, if you're lucky, going out like Bing Crosby did on the sixth hole.
Yes, maybe in for me it would be in section 39 of Memorial Stadium in Baltimore watching the Orioles win another one.
I'd get hit by a ball.
Right, right.
Well, let me ask you a couple of questions about yourself. You studied at Chapel Hill, right?
Right. And
then you went into journalism. What was your father's reaction to this?
My father was so relieved that I had gainful employment that any reservations he may have had about a son going into a profession that he did not think of as a profession but as a rather unseemly trade, he was very grateful. He was also thrilled because, as it happened, I walked out of Chapel Hill in the spring of 1961 into a clerkship with James Reston in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times, and my parents thought James Reston was the best journalist in the country, and for his son to be the first of, I guess, about 30 clerks who have worked for him was a real thrill for them. And so any reservations they may have felt about my straying from the range and not being a teacher or a preacher were certainly ameliorated by their pleasure in that.
Was this clerkship something like an internship?
Yes. In fact, Mr. Reston's, one of his good friends in those days was Felix Frankfurter, and Frankfurter used to say to him, look, Scotty, if a Supreme Court justice can have a clerk, why can't the chief of the Washington Bureau of the New York Times?
Did they pay you?
They paid me. I should have paid them, but they paid me.
So we have a series of internships here, and they're not paid. They get college credits.
But you see, I was out of college. I can tell you that I was paid $105 a week.
Well, that's not bad.
In 1961, that wasn't bad.
No, 1961, I think I was making 90.
Well, and that $15 difference was big in 1961.
Well, I was working in the Midwest, and you were...
Well, it went farther in the Midwest than it did in Washington.
But your first full... time job, I guess, or full paid job was where, at the Miami Herald?
Oh, no. No, my first full job was with Mr. Reston, and I went from there a year later in the spring of 62 up here in New York, where I wrote for the News of the Week and Review and the Times for about 2.5 years. Then I went to Greensboro, North Carolina, the Greensboro Daily News in 64. I stayed there for...
What did you do there?
I was an editorial writer, and I became, in addition to that, the book editor, which is how I started down my path to literary perdition. I had a year during that...
Perdition.
I had a year as a Nieman Fellow at Harvard during that period. That year it helped me persuaded me that I really wanted to spend my life dealing with books rather than as an editorialist. And I went to the Miami Herald in 1974 as its book editor, stayed there for 5 years, wrote, during that period, wrote and published with Random House a biography of Ring Lardner, came to the Washington Star in the late 78, stayed there till it died in August of 81, and I had an extraordinary stroke of good fortune in that 3 months before the Star folded, I won the Pulitzer Prize for criticism, and I'm sure that helped me get the very enviable position I have at the Washington Post now.
Yeah. So you're a columnist with the
Post. I write two book reviews a week, and I write a weekly column, which is not a political column. It's more social or literary or cultural.
And you're based in Baltimore.
Yes, I that's just a matter of choice. Although I must say that being 45 miles away from Washington and Washington's sort of literary journalistic community is helpful to me because it gives me a certain distance and detachment that as a book reviewer is very helpful.
You don't have to go in every day.
I go in every Monday. Use a computer and a modem.
You can modem your stuff.
Yes.
When I lived in Baltimore, I loved it. And it's such a matter of fact, one of the big literary stories that we covered in my early years there was when Ogden Nash moved to Baltimore.
Right.
And got a garden apartment out there. All the photographers went out to see him.
Right.
It's got a strong literary history. I mean, Fitzgerald is walking in the streets.
Oh, sure.
Poe died there.
H.L. Mencken, Poe's house. Ann Tyler lives there now.
John Barth
is there. Taylor Branch has only recently moved.
Hammett,
right? The Inner Harbor, right in the heart of downtown, is now very lively and bustling and really the center of the city. It's to anybody who knew Baltimore 25 years ago, it seems very strange, but Baltimore is now a tourist attraction.
Let me, just to wrap things up, let me ask you now, you're a book critic, and sometimes I'll pick up the Times. I usually don't get the Washington Post, but I read as much criticism as I can, and some of the criticism is absolutely scathing, absolutely. And I wondered about that. I mean, why? I'm not addressing you, but why does a literary critic bother to review a book that he is trashing in the most obnoxious way?
Well, I think there are certain books that go out into the marketplace with a lot of hoopla behind them, a lot of promotion, a lot of publicity. And for that reason, they come prominently to readers' attention. If a book reviewer reads one of these and thinks it's a piece of junk, my candid answer would be that that's something that the reader needs to be told. At its
But that's an opinion.
Of course
so
it's an opinion. Of course
junk.
It's... Well, listen.
The review could be
listen.
Junky.
Oh, I know. But listen. Readers are not stupid. Readers know that. If readers did what book critics told them to do, the bestseller list would look very, very different.
I mean, Michener would never sell another book.
Yeah, and it would, you know, Saul Bellow and someone like Ann Tyler to be both praised critically and to sell exceptionally well, that is really, really rare. By and large, the bestseller list is a book critic's nightmare. And, you know, I always say when people ask me about it that the most important thing a book reviewer can carry in his baggage is a large load of humility, the knowledge that you are not going to be a very important factor in a reader's decision about buying a book. You can maybe help persuade, but the book critic does not have the power to order a single reader to do a single thing. All you can do is try to be persuasive.
To persuade the reader to do what? Not read the book?
To persuade the reader that your judgment of this book is valid. I've been the book critic of
but
the...
But anybody's judgment of a book is valid.
Sure, but I have been the book critic of the Washington Post for 8 years now. I've been a professional book reviewer since 1965, almost a quarter of a century. Whether I am any good or not is for each individual reader to decide, but I have a history, just as anybody else who gets out in a public forum has a history. Russell Baker has a history of social commentary and humor, and people know... They have a relationship with Russell Baker, the reader to the writer. Well, my readers have a relationship to me. I know that a lot of them think I'm a bunch of hooey. That's fine. They're entitled. There are other people who think that, who over the years have realized that their judgments and mine coincide enough so that I may be a fairly reliable guide for them. I have that kind of relationship as a reader with, say, Stanley Kaufman, the film critic of the New Republic. I've been reading him for as long as he's been in there, I think, and I don't always agree with him. But more often than not, I find that he points me to movies that interest me and steers me away from movies that don't. And, of course, I know it's opinion, but it's opinion I trust.
Well, let me approach this in a different way. Here is your memoir, story of your family. You worked hard on this book. You cared. You
right.
felt when you wrote this. And in my opinion, it's an achievement. Now, someone else who's been a critic for 25 years can be extremely jaundiced about the books
Absolutely.
He receives and look at it and say, what do I care? I'm some middle-class wasp.
Absolutely.
You know, and he doesn't even write well and put this, you know, dismiss it.
Right.
My feeling has been that anybody who seeks to write a book, even not a very good book, has tried to do something and deserves at least a C- for effort. It's true, there are some books that completely fail, but it is so difficult to write a book. You expended a great deal of effort
mm-hmm.
to put this thing together, and somebody who does a piece of art like this,
mm-hmm.
off, completely off the top of her head,
mm-hmm.
Needs encouragement more than criticism.
Well,
In other words, I guess what I'm saying is, if there is a review, I think the review should be balanced. I think that the review should seek as many pluses as minuses.
My response to that would be that the book critic or the critic of anything who is honest and professional goes into each book or each movie or each art show or whatever with an open mind. I always hope that I will find pleasure and satisfaction in the book that I'm about to read. I'm hoping that I will be able to say to my readers, here is a book that is worth your time, attention, and money. But it's then up to the book, the author of the book, to justify my hopes. My experience at this stage in my life, I must have reviewed several thousand books, is that by and large one's hopes are not fulfilled. The question is, how much is one disappointed? What has the author managed to accomplish despite the author's shortcomings, the failures? Where does the balance lie? But I don't think readers are looking for a balanced review in the sense this is the good stuff and this is the bad stuff. I think what readers are looking for is a fair review, and whether it's negative or positive is up to the reviewer to make a plausible case.
Do you consider yourself a tough critic?
Yes. I like to think I'm fair, but I couldn't. When I come to the gate and St. Peter asks me about it, I'll have to ask him to make that judgment.
Well, I'm glad you didn't review my book.
I'm sorry that I didn't know about it. What you're doing and what I'm doing are different things.
Yes.
I think there's an equally valid role for both of them. And I, as an author who is trying to interest readers in a book that is difficult to describe in a few words, I'm obviously grateful for the chance to, as any author would be, for the chance to sit with you in the studio and to talk about what I've tried to do.
Jonathan Yardley, our kind of people, very moving, very nice story. Thank you very much.
Thank you.